So Texas is going to the Big 12 Championship, facing Oklahoma once again. But we hope you pretend we're football as we talk basketball for the next hour. I'm your host, Will Baser, and I'm joined alongside by Johnny Brashear and Tim Preston. You guys are listening to the Hornscast channel. It's the Hornscast channel here on Podbean, Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, anywhere you guys can find a podcast. So Texas just got back from going, you know, for Las Vegas, they're pretty lucky, had a 50% win percentage there, going 1-1 against UNC and MSU, both top 11 teams. So we're going to talk about what happened there, why it happened, and what you should take away from the Las Vegas Invitational, then get into Radford as the Radford Highlanders come to Texas after they knocked off Notre Dame. How much stock should you put into that win, and what should you expect from the Radford Highlanders on the court? But, again, as I said, it's hate week. Texas OU. So let's talk about, for pretend you're getting to know us, your favorite hate week or Texas OU week memory. Who wants to start here? Tim, let's go with you first.
Sounds good. Well, as the... I mean, I was born in Austin, but by the time I was truly a Texas fan, we lived in San Antonio, and then in my real formative years, we were actually well away. So I was a Texas OU or Texas OU watcher from miles and miles and miles away. I think probably my very favorite Texas OU memory was, you know... There was something very special in 05. Is that the Vince Young,
yep.
Rhett Bomar year? So living in Iowa and being around at that time, like Texas was very good and certainly had some great years under Mack Brown. But that year when they crushed the Rhett Bomar-led OU team, I had a bunch of my friends over. We were hanging out in my basement. And one of my good friends was drinking Smirnoff Ice because it's delicious, no matter what you guys say. And he got into this argument with his girlfriend, and she was all pissy that he was there watching a football game in the first place. And long story short, he told her to go fuck herself because he was going to watch the Texas OU game with Timmy, which he started to do, and then left about 15 minutes in because he realized he couldn't do any better. And
Been there.
I was then one of the groomsmen in their wedding. So that was unfortunate. But that was the year when Vince Young beat Bomar. You know, I've watched them all since, I don't know, probably 92, 93, something like that, being fortunate that they are always the early game or just very regularly the early game. And you know, I haven't had the chance. I've never been to the State Fair. With that, I've never had a chance to. The only time that I've ever watched a game in the Cotton Bowl was Notre Dame versus A&M, like the actual Cotton Bowl game on New Year's Day. Like I don't even know what year that was, probably 97, something like that. I don't remember exactly for sure. So I am for sure the foreigner to that. But even from far away, it's been a pretty big deal, and I am pretty jazzed for Texas beating the shit out of them this week. That'd be awesome.
So. I'll go because Johnny, you said yours was good, so we're gonna put this all on your shoulders here. So I'll go.
I can't possibly live up to this.
Yeah,
now.
I'll go so that basically you fail us in spectacular fashion. So mine is actually not going to the Texas OU game. It was the fact that I missed my own lacrosse game to listen on to the Texas game on the radio. So. What happens is when we were in college, if we didn't go down for the game, Texas would win because my dad would say, Texas is so bad this year. Why are you going? They're going to get blown out. And then when we don't go, they win. And when we do, they lose. So it happened to me. It's happened to my brother. It's happened to my sister. It's a Baser curse. So basically, if we're in college, you don't go to the game. Although my brother went this year and they won, so I don't know. Whatever. But
I think that means your youngest brother is the chosen one.
Yeah, it probably is. He should go to more games, but he lives in nowhere, Virginia. So not quite practical. But this year I went, it was 2003. It was when Case McCoy was just, he got the crap leveled out of him, but still won the game. Where he, there's always that one gif that Oklahoma fans use where Case McCoy gets just clothesline.
Oh, you mean?
And like does a flip.
2013,
okay. Right.
All
right. So I am heading to my game, just listening to the OU game because I didn't want to see the carnage. Texas was like terrible. They just got destroyed by BYU, and Oklahoma was looking like they're on fire. So I was like, I don't want to watch Texas get absolutely murdered on national television. Little do I know, Case McCoy was going to have the game of his life. And while I'm sitting in my car, waiting, getting ready for my preseason lacrosse game, my fall ball lacrosse game, they start winning, and I'm just like, Coach, I'm not getting out of this car. I'm not going to play today. I'm sorry. I'm going back to my room to watch this game. So I had to do a few extra sprints after practice, but
it was worth it.
Oh, the Marcus Johnson touchdown on the post route. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, the fly pattern. Yeah. Yes. That was special.
Yeah. So, Johnny, what about you, man?
So I don't know if you remember me talking about this, that Christmas where my cat got run over.
Oh, of course. Yeah. It's one of the best show moments of the show.
Well, I had another cat get run over during Texas OU week.
Dude, how many cats have you had gotten run over?
Okay, actually, that didn't happen.
Why is this your favorite?
It didn't. Okay. Well, it was a terrible cat. No, this didn't actually happen. You built up what I was going to talk about so much that I felt like I had to just outright lie. my favorite Texas OU memory was not, it doesn't involve me at all. I will forever love the Stoney Clark block at the goal line the end of, what was that? That was 94. I don't know. It was maybe earlier than
I wasn't very old,
but yeah, no, it's, that I remember seeing that live not in person, unfortunately. I went to 3 Texas OU games, but that was not one of them. And it was, that one was the one where everybody, absolutely lost their shit when they saw it. Cause it was like, oh fuck, here comes Oklahoma, like about to win this game. And Stoney Clark out of the middle of nowhere just blocks that dude at the goal line. He now makes cookies. I don't understand why, but he does, and I will buy them if I ever see them, just as like, you know, a small bit of gratitude for saving my sanity that one Saturday.
And my favorite part of it is his name, Stoney. Like Stonewalled, Oklahoma, yep. Stoney. It makes for a great story.
Yes.
Textbook great story.
Very much.
But I guess if you're talking like favorite game moments, this past game, like the past Red River Shootout, has to be one of my favorite moments, with Dicker the Kicker winking at the camera, then going out there and ruining Oklahoma's hearts. Unfortunately, that game might get soiled. I don't know.
It's,
I don't
now
say that, but
yeah, it's now meaningless.
I don't know, man. The Obanaya run was pretty special too. That was awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. But you're right, Johnny.
If we're going to make it topical, then Emba Amute horns down in that terrible season when Texas was down by, what was it, like 22? Did the horns down, and then they came back and won.
You just said that's the UCLA guy.
Oh, who am I thinking of?
Amada or something like that?
You have to look that guy up. Yeah.
Who's the Kyler Murray of Texas basketball?
The Kyler Murray
of Texas? Basketball?
Just a guy who was really good, but also just a huge, huge douche.
Oh, Gabe Benecki, if you're talking about Texas basketball.
No, not of Texas, but like Texas played them. Like, you just hate them.
From OU?
Any team.
Oh.
Amath Mbaye. That was him. He's who did the horns down.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so who is the Kyler Murray?
Yeah.
For
went
Texas
to, went
basketball.
Went to A&M, went to Oklahoma, is now in the news for saying that he doesn't respect or has no comment on if he respects Sam Ellinger.
Boy.
Is just not a very likable dude.
I hated Kelvin Sampson, but I liked his player. Like, I hated Nahara, but it's tough to really pick out a guy from his. He had a lot of, like, high caliber, like, high integrity guys when he was there. I did not hate his players when he was there.
Eddie Nahara is the Kyler Murray of Oklahoma basketball.
Yeah, I mean, so if you're looking for a guy from Oklahoma, yeah, Eduardo Nahara is the guy because he's just, you know, a total buttfuck. But yeah, anywhere else, I don't know, anywhere else, maybe like a guy who had it out for Texas and kind of hated us, and
I'm just,
but also was.
Are we trying to think of somebody from Texas that was like that? Because
anybody? No. Who played Texas?
Oh, who played Texas? I don't know. Did Christian Laettner ever play Texas?
I can see we're getting nowhere with this question. Yeah. So let's go ahead and just dive right into what happened this weekend, this past weekend against UNC and Michigan State. We'll start off with UNC because at least I didn't see it, but on hindsight 2020, the fact that Texas was 1-7 against Roy Williams in his offense, I guess it's just like Texas to Nebraska football is UNC to Texas basketball. I think you actually tweeted that out, Johnny.
Yeah, I did. We occupy a special place in hell for Roy Williams. Does not. It's, you know, it's something about...
In hell, Roy Williams plays Texas every game.
Yes. Yeah, except he's 0-7 against him. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a combination of the wide-open offense that Roy Williams plays that is... I mean, it's not super structured, I guess. There is some structure to it, but it is fairly free-flowing. And Texas having... This coach and the previous coach being defensive-minded coaches that are good at mucking up offenses without a ton of structure. Like, offenses that thrive in transition tend to struggle against Rick Barnes and Shaka Smart teams. And Roy just... It's hard to say that Roy is lazy because that's not the word I want to use. It's like... Roy is betting on the fact that his athletes are going to defeat yours, and he's got however many wins at this point to back it up. I mean, he's won like 80% of his games lifetime. So, I mean, obviously there's some merit to what he's thinking. But Texas tends to have athletes close to, if not on par with what Roy has. And so that sort of structural athletic advantage isn't there anymore, with the two relative teams. And so... I think it's just some sort of combination of that, you know, the defensive-minded coaches and the, you know, sort of level athletic playing field tends to make Texas punch above its weight against North Carolina.
And UNC is a team that I think has almost always carried the identity of their coach very much so. I think that they were obviously a Dean Smith team when he was around, and they are very obviously a Roy Williams team now that he's around. And Roy is... As Johnny said, a guy that is very comfortable in his own skin, like he's not going to change. He's okay saying like, all right, we might lose a game here or there, but we know eventually we're gonna get these wins. And it's, you know, his results bear that out. I think that what we saw for three of the halves in Las Vegas is that if you are comfortable running with Texas, you are giving them their best chance of being successful at the highest of levels. So when the Tar Heels came out and like they would not pack it in, when Michigan State came out in the first half and they kind of followed suit from the rest of their season, Michigan State's been playing pretty fast this year and they would not pack it in, or at least they weren't able to. Texas was like, all right, dude, let's do this. And I think for the entirety of that first game, it was interesting to see North Carolina try to say, all right, eventually we're going to hit more shots than you. We're going to find opportunities to make your players make plays. And again, Texas is like, all right, if it's 1v1, if we can get an open lane and we have to beat you to a spot, we're going to do it. And they did it over and over and over again.
Yep.
And that was pretty cool to see. Michigan State later on did something different. And so, you know, we'll talk about that as it comes. But I think that when North Carolina made some adjustments, they were making adjustments trying to, again, like... they were comfortable being spread out defensively. They were comfortable trying to 1v1 us as far as like even in the paint, like looking for offensive rebounds. And so they were very rarely shifting over early. If someone was going to come over, it's almost as if they were going to come over later for defensive rebounds, or they were not committing multiple guys into the lane when we were getting penetration. And so when Roach was there, he had to finish against a late rotating big man, or he had to finish against a defense that was shifting as he came through. And time after time, he's like, all right, well, I'm pretty comfortable against this. And then on top of Roach playing a terrific game, they got some good three-point shooting. And Williams just, like, kept on playing his game and kept on playing his game. And to his credit, I will say this. Williams doing that against Texas doesn't make a lot of sense. He's probably playing the long game saying, we're not going to play Texas in the Elite Eight. And he's probably right. If he does, we may well beat him. But if he plays a team like Arizona, or he plays a team like Purdue at that level, he'll probably beat them with that game. But when he plays Texas, when he plays our athletes, when he plays guys that can defend in the open floor like we can, it's generally speaks to a pretty specific way that our coaches have recruited over the last 15, 20 years.
So, and here's the thing I kind of take away from it as well is, at its best, Texas can be North Carolina. And think of all the success North Carolina has had. Now, obviously, they don't have the consistency of Roy Williams as a coach or the consistency as UNC as a program, but they're pretty similar ball clubs. Am I wrong in saying that?
Oh, you're not wrong in saying that, but I think that we here's what they do better than us. If our normal recruit is in the 40s to 60 range, their normal recruit is in the 20 to 40 range. And so very right. consistently, they get a little bit better athlete, a little bit more consistent shooter, a little bit more skilled kind of player. Not that they're way better, or not that they're totally in a different ballpark, but they do get guys who, when stuff does break down, when they're playing a Duke, when they're playing a Virginia, when they're playing a Wake Forest, like, they are comfortable taking a little bit more time when they have to, where Texas doesn't quite have that multi-dimensional player that North Carolina is able to recruit that we just can't right now. I think Shaka is going to get
Kobe White.
We just don't have that guy. We don't. And of course,
we don't have the Nasir Little coming off the bench.
Yeah. You know, and if Shaka had been able to get Quentin Grimes, this would be, you know, maybe the answer is different, you know, or if Barnes or Shaka had been able to land what's that other guy? Never mind. Cut this part out. But if Texas had been able to land a Quentin Grimes, who was the guy that went to Kentucky? Who was the point guard that went to Kentucky? De'Aaron Fox. De'Aaron Fox. Like, you know, if they get a player like that, if Texas gets a Keldon Johnson, if Texas gets if they get Quentin Grimes, all of a sudden the Longhorns are looking at a different kind of level. We're not landing that guy right now. And so while we can sneak up and beat North Carolina, the reason that they are still a little bit more successful at the tournament level is both because Roy Williams has been there before a lot of times, and because they just have a little bit different athlete, even though we are able to beat them head-to-head occasionally. Well, most of the time, apparently. So.
Yeah, and there are three stats, and actually four, and Johnny, I'm going to need your help on this one. I'm going to need an assist that I think really speak to the success Texas had here. And I'm guessing y'all can break it down even more here. Texas was 52.5% shooting from the field goal. That's their best all year long, including against teams like Eastern Illinois and ULM. They were 45.8% from three-point range. So just they were on fire there. It seems like they couldn't miss at times. And they were also forcing 17 turnovers on UNC, and a lot of those turnovers weren't just like they traveled or something that would happen to Texas, which was like they just gave up the ball. It was they were forced into a pickle. They were forced into a trap.
A live ball turnover.
Exactly. And the turnovers were forced. Now, Johnny, here's why I need your help. How many points were scored off those turnovers?
I'm going to have to look that up.
Ken Pom.
He doesn't have that.
He doesn't?
No.
Okay. Never mind.
It's like, it was close to 30. Yeah. I mean, because they were above 20, I want to say, in the first half.
So just take our word for it. A ridiculous number of points were scored off of turnovers in both games. In both games. Definitely in UNC, that was a large factor for Kerwin Roach's, three highlight dunks, and a lot of the points he scored were off of transition buckets that were caused off of turnovers. And that's how Texas you know, they take care of the rebounds. You know, they're not the tallest team. Jackson Hayes is the only guy who really can out-rebound guys, but even he's not the strongest or has the IQ, the court IQ, to rebound against guys. But Texas can make up for it by causing turnovers, by cutting possessions short with the turnovers, getting steals and all that type of jazz.
I'd agree with that, and I think that Texas, again, where we've seen Texas for since 1998 or 99, whatever it was when Rick came around, Texas was so rebound-oriented, we almost gave up on some of the steals, like the live ball turnovers. Like this, that was never our strength. Whereas this year is one of the first times where we're seeing shock. It's not havoc, but we are seeing a very purposeful movement towards how can we get our hands on balls? How can that's every time I say it, how can we get ourselves like playing passing angles and getting some deflections? Offensively, what North Carolina did more so to me in that game, they blitzed every single ball screen. I mean, they blitzed hard every single ball screen where they would have two defenders hedging hard or trying to cut off angles on our ball screen. And consistently, Matt and Kerwin kept the dribble up and were able to find an outlet either at the middle of the court or were able to turn the corner a little bit. And so we were playing 4-on-3 against North Carolina anytime we got ball penetration into the lane. And so there's a reason we shot really well because we had open threes. There's a reason we shot really well because we were able to get lane penetration. There's a reason that we finished at the lane because we were, you know, we're playing with an advantage almost every single time. And so when you have a defensive system like North Carolina ran, where they were kind of playing into our hands, where we're very comfortable playing against a blitzing screen, like we can get the ball and we can keep the ball going. And on top of the fact that we were also causing turnovers or forcing turnovers, there's a reason that Texas looked really good. Even though North Carolina is a terrific team, they're terrific. But we had kind of a perfect storm with that of they played a defensive style that was okay with us, and our defense looked pretty good. So that was in no small part of our victory.
Yeah, I think to your earlier point, Will, about turnovers and forcing turnovers, one of the things that Texas is able to play an aggressive style of defense that may not be the quote-unquote havoc that fans seem to want to see, but it has the same impact without having to stretch defenders across the entire floor. They can play the diamond press. They do employ it sometimes, but they are getting turnovers. They are forcing turnovers without extending the defense, which is in some ways harder to accomplish, but they're managing to do it. To put sort of a bow on it, right now Texas is forcing turnovers on 25% of its defensive possessions.
That's silly. That's just dumb.
Yeah, to put that in perspective, last year West Virginia, who was second in the nation, did it 23.4% of the time. So right now Texas, and granted that stat is not going to hold the entire time, just because they'll get into conference play and they'll meet some better guards who take care of the ball a little better. But they're 15th in the nation right now in terms of percentage of time they turn over the other team. And when you add in
without playing a pressing defense,
right? Yeah, they press some, but not a ton. Like it's, you know, maybe half as often as West Virginia did last year. So it's a fairly significant amount, but it's not, you know, it's not 40 minutes of hell or anything like that. And the other part of that is that when they are on offense, they don't turn the ball over. They're somehow getting better and better at it as the season has gone on, where they are only turning the ball over 15.5% of the time, which is top 30 in the nation. So when you have a team that may have inconsistent shooting, like Texas has shown, you know, with their troubles from three, one way to counteract this, and it's the way West Virginia has operated for the last two or three years, is you can counteract not being a good shooting team by generating extra possessions to shoot. And that is what Texas is doing thus far this year. They're doing it better than almost anybody in the country right now.
Right. If you're not good at shooting, become a Jimmy Fredette and become a volume shooter.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, if you take 10 threes and you only make three of them at a time, that's still more points than if you take five and make two.
Right. Well, yeah, technically.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. Percentage, you know, the percentage is worse, 30 versus 40, but five extra shots got you three more points. So at the end of the day, as much as efficiency metrics matter and as much as percentages matter, the only counting stat that really matters is the points on the scoreboard. And so whatever you got to do to generate more of those than the other team does, that's what matters.
Then quick question. I just want you to
take a moment to really appreciate how eloquent that last statement was. I was very proud of myself.
Very eloquent, Johnny. Thank you. Some of your best work on the show.
Yeah, we can bring in Jeff now. I'm done.
He's going to end off on a high note.
Yeah.
But before you do that, summarize for me why Texas won this game. Why did Texas win this game? What caused it? Was it just because Curran Roach had a crazy performance, or were there some details behind it that were the real reason? Some schematic details? What was it?
I mean, at the end of the day, that was the primary factor, because Coby White was unconscious for most of the game for North Carolina. I mean, he really was. He was hitting a variety of shots, guarded and unguarded, and Texas needed somebody or somebodies to answer him, and Roach did that in a phenomenally efficient way. I mean, when you generate 32 points off of, what was it, 15 shots, I think, that's a pretty phenomenal way to go about your day. So, I mean, yes, as much as there are, you know, sort of schematic things we could talk about, at the end of the day, Roach went shot for shot with Coby White, and that's why this, you know, really impressive offensive performance came out with a W instead of an L. Because if Roach is 90% of what he was, Texas may have a great offensive performance and lose by two instead of winning by three.
They were good to pretty good everywhere. And so if you can pick a narrative over Texas's last 3 years, once again, it's been that they have been fine in some parts of some aspects of their game, and then not so fine in others. And so against North Carolina, they were solid to very solid all over the court, and they got a really fantastic game from Kerwin. So when you can combine a great game from one of your star players who's going to play a bunch of minutes on top of everyone else playing very fine, that's how good teams beat other really good teams, right? You can't have shitty games from half of your lineup and hope to beat a team like North Carolina. And that has been kind of the story of Texas the last couple of years, is that Kerwin might have a great game and then Andrew struggles, or Andrew might have a great game but Mo struggles, or whatever it might be. And against North Carolina, you can't really point to a person other than Dylan the first maybe 5 or 6 minutes of that game and say, wow, that was trash. But even Dylan picked it up by the end. Like, he was okay towards the rest of that game.
Yeah, his second half was very good.
Yeah, I hit the three to put him up by one at the halftime, I want to say.
Yeah.
So you would hope that Shaka's team, now that it's 100% his, would start figuring those things out. They look to do so, and they got a big win.
So let's switch gears here from UNC, which was, for most parts, a generally great game played for Texas, except for the first half of the first half, where the first half of the first half for the Michigan State game was wonderful until Joshua Langford woke up from his 11-minute hibernation and just went off on Texas, shooting 5 for 6 from 3, 10 for 16 from the field, scored 29 points, helped out with Cassius Winston, who went 4 from 8 from 3, 5 from 11 from the field goal, 20 points. I mean, Michigan State couldn't miss from 3. They were 60%. Which was better than their overall field goal percentage, which was 51%. Whereas Texas, in the first half of the first half, was really, really good in shooting the three. I mean, they didn't miss. It was like a heat check, and they'd knock it down. But they ended off the game.
They were like 5 of 11, I think, in the first 10 minutes, something like that.
Yeah, unbelievable. And then when you get to the end of the game, 9 for 34. 22 for 64 on field goal percentage in general. So 34% field goal, 26.5% from three. Texas went, what was it, 0 for 12 on field goals at one point. They had four points over a span of 10 minutes. We saw huge spans like that last year that were troubling. So tell me, what happened between that first half of the first half to the rest of that game? Why, how did you know, why didn't Michigan State shut it down? I'm sure that's an easy question, but why didn't Texas, how could Texas not really, you know, shut down a guy like Joshua Langford? I mean, that guy just seemed like he couldn't miss.
To speak towards what was going on Michigan State's side of the offense, or their offense, they had two guards who, I mean, they were getting guarded. They were just hitting big shots. I mean, there might have been a couple here and there where they had, you know, open catch and shoot threes, but some of those they were burying with a hand in their face. And, you know, at a certain point, you just sort of got to tip your cap to somebody who's that hot. And, you know, that's the kind of guy that Tom Izzo likes to bring into his program. There's always some one or two of those guys on each of his teams that just, that, you know, they step up in the big moments and they go 5 of 8 from three, or, you know, do something like that. There's always some guard that's just, you know, it's like he just plugs in another junior guard who ends up scoring 22 points on somebody in a big time game. As far as Texas side of things, really the difference, in my opinion, although I'm not an ex-Texas basketball coach, so maybe they have different opinions, but I was watching what they were doing in the first half, and while their bigs were hedging, during the pick and roll situations, they were dropping off pretty quickly. And they would either take an angle, like sort of a diagonal angle back into the lane, or they would just run out immediately to catch up with the big that was rolling in the pick and roll. And that allowed Roach and Coleman and, you know, Ramey to a limited degree to get into the lane and either take a shot close to the rim or hit the open guy in the corner to take a wide open three. You know, the lane penetration was allowing a lot of good looks for Texas. And towards the last, especially in the second half, Izzo was forcing his bigs to hedge a lot harder, that they would hang out there for an extra, you know, quarter, half second to stymie the guard. And then they would, you know, head back. It was they were giving the other guard that little extra moment to catch up to get through the screen, and that kept Coleman, that kept Roach, that kept all the guards from being able to turn the corner and get into the lane as easily as they had. And when they weren't turning the corner, when they were stuck outside, you know, stuck at the top of the arc, rather than making that move down to the lane, then the pass they're making to the guy in the corner, or to, you know, if Osakowski was filling in the spot behind him, those guys were guarded a lot more closely. The shots weren't as open. The offense hasn't moved as much, so it hasn't forced the defense to move as much. So just it wasn't as high a quality a shot as they were getting in the first 10 to 12 minutes of the game. And you know, that 3-point percentage got a little warped by the last 3 or 4 minutes where they were chucking it up, just trying to get back into what was a 10 to 12 point deficit. But it's still like the entire second half, those shots were just tougher for them, and they weren't, the quality of them was not as good. And, you know, that's why a guy like Izzo is a Hall of Fame coach, is he makes those adjustments that forces a team like Texas into a level of discomfort that they just didn't get over.
I mean, 44 points in the first half, 24 points in the second half. That's an incredible adjustment from Tom Izzo.
It is, and I think you can look at what he did in that second half and say, good job, Izzo, nice job forcing Texas into some tough spots. I think what he did is probably very similar from what you're going to see in the Big 12 a decent amount for us, and that is if you take a dot probably between, I don't know, like this at like the 8 foot mark in the middle of the free throw lane, and just like do a 7 or 8 foot circle. That is where Texas has struggled all year long. Like, we've been very good at the rim. We've been good like up to like 4 or 5 feet from the rim. We've been good on slips when we have obvious advantage there. We have found some good opportunities to like kick out to the 3-point line from there. But if you make us execute inside of that circle, where they have to be decent in the mid-range shots, that's where we're going to struggle. We just are. I mean, Roach is a tremendous athlete, but he's not super skilled in there. Coleman wants to get all the way to the rim. Eli wants to totally get all the way to the rim. Ramey is still kind of like finding his groove in that area. So that's kind of our no man's land where we don't feel as comfortable. And so Izzo did a great job of making sure that if we were going to find open areas, it was going to be open area right inside there. And we don't have a wing forward or a power forward that you know is very comfortable in that spot. So we're going to have to figure out if that's the spot that people are giving us, how do we take advantage of that look in the mid to high lane, not quite to the free throw line or right around the free throw line and a little bit above that. Can we get good looks out of that where we can get good post dumps, where we can find some dunks? Can we find Jackson or Jericho where they can make a post move? Can we get in there and still cause a defense to move or force the defense to move and get a three-point look? Or if we have to take a shot, are we going to take that shot and be in the 40 to 45% range from that? And right now, I just don't think we're at that. So if all the good things you would take from Las Vegas are there, the negative would be, okay, well, what's Kansas State going to do against us when they make us play from that spot? What's Kansas going to do against us when they make us play from that spot? What is Iowa State or whatever Big 12 team going to make us do if we have to initiate offense from that point in the lane? And I think that, you know, where we struggled is not a super surprise. We'll get better, but we're going to have to prove that we can make that offense work from there.
Yeah, one thing I would like to see them do at least a handful of times, so it's on tape and we have some way of looking at it, is to see, you know, at the end of the day, it's a pick and roll, and I would like to see them hit the roll guy here and there on those pick and rolls, because if those guys are going to hedge like that, then the guard who has the ball has to have the ability to at least loft that ball up so that a guy like Hayes or Sims can go get it. Because it's honestly, I mean, I don't want to say it's not difficult. It's the timing is very intricate, but conceptually it's not that difficult to, if they are not going to respect the role guy, to hit that guy. I mean, and again, like when you got guys like Sims and Hayes who can outjump basically everybody on this earth that's not in the NBA, then throw it up above the rim. Just, I mean, it's a lob pass at that point. And, yeah, you know, Hayes, one of the things he's shown is he's got an incredible ability to catch at the rim and flush it. So
he has Mo Bamba's go-go gadget arms.
Yeah.
Well, and if you want to criticize Matt for one big thing this year, I understand Roach not doing it because he's still a combo guard. He's still a scoring guard who wants to look for his own shot. But Matt should be taking advantage of that every time. And I felt like he did that as well as anybody could have with Mo last year. And this year, with two guys that can still jump, you know, at least somewhat comparably to Mo, that should be a much bigger staple of our offense. It hasn't been so far.
Yeah, or at least enough so that the bigs have the defensive bigs have to consider that possibility when they're hedging, and maybe they drop a split second earlier so that lane opens up a little bit for a guy like Coleman.
Well, we should be able to finish even if they're playing for the slip.
Yeah,
I mean, like, okay, yeah, play for the slip, we'll be fine. Like, Jackson will out jump you, Jericho will out jump you. We can still make that work, but we're not hitting that. And Shaka talked about that today in his press conference, where he said, you know, we need to figure out that timing, and that's legit. Like, he's right, but that should not be this hard. Like, we should be able to find that much more consistently. Of when we see the hedge, okay, we're reverting back to the center of the lane, and we're going to find that opportunity there. So that, if anything else, that's a pretty good feeling for moving forward. Like, because we are doing all of this and not taking advantage of what should be almost a primary part of our offense.
So then I guess my question for y'all would be, to kind of wrap up the Michigan State game, was Texas's downfall in the second half, was that more Shaka Smart getting outcoached by a Hall of Fame coach, Tom Izzo, or the Texas Michigan State playing lights out from 3-point range, or Texas players doing something wrong? What's going on there?
Well, if you look back to Michigan State's first 5 or 6 games, they played really fast. I think they scored 80 plus points in all of their first few games, even when they lost to Kansas. And
their tempo stats are pretty high.
Yeah, which is not un-Izzo-like, but certainly when games have gotten tight for Izzo throughout the years, there's always been that reversion to, okay, we're going to pack it in, we're going to out-rebound you, we're going to out-physical you. And I was surprised at how fast Michigan State played, or at least how unable they were to get us out of our quickness in that first half. And so you could almost say that, like, that Shaka totally outcoached him in the first half, because it's pretty easy against Texas right now to say, what do you want to do against us? Well, we want to limit tempo. We want to, you know, against Texas, you're going to want to, you know, make sure you play under screens, make them dribble penetrate against a set defense. And Michigan State didn't do that, which is pretty dumb, honestly, that Izzo tried to get out and run with us, or at least move, you know, pretty fast against us, which was pretty silly. And then when they slowed things down, a couple things happened. First of all, like you said, Will, they had a couple of guards who went apeshit. So, all right, you know, even really good players might not shoot what they shot against air. So, you know, good for Michigan State. And I love Izzo. He's, you know, he's a stand-up guy.
I mean, they basically had two guys who did what Kobe White did the night before, but like 75% for each. So you got 150% of Kobe White.
Yeah, pretty much.
For sure. Yeah. And Texas, look, Texas is going to struggle. They are going to struggle against a defense that wants them to have to slow it down. And it was kind of the perfect storm of Texas wasn't hitting shots. Michigan State was slowing it down. Michigan State was hitting shots, which meant that every single time we were going back, we had to inbounds the ball. And so we couldn't really beat them in transition, even if things were like, you know, neutral or even positive for us. It was tough to beat them because they were ready to be reset because they had hit a shot. So they could get a 2 or 3 second head start down the floor. So, you know, Texas is still going to have to prove that they can function inside of that kind of style of game, and you know that's no different than what we thought a week ago. But happy to see that they could do what they could do against the other three halves or in the other three halves of that tournament.
Yeah, I guess I would say that I am more optimistic than pessimistic based off of what I saw this weekend. That
for sure.
You know, the shooting, the 3-point shooting for 3 out of 4 halves in Vegas against high-level competition was trending in the right direction. That they look like they are, you know, when you add that into the game prior against the Citadel, that is now a pretty, you know, decent sample size of them actually shooting, you know, not just executing to get the right shot, but the shot actually falling. So there's, you know, there's hope at least that they could be a serviceable 3-point shooting team with moments of really great 3-point shooting. And I think the fact that they went through, you know, when we talked about last week, it was if we're ranking the three teams and most likely to least likely to beat, Michigan State was at the bottom of the three for me, by a considerable amount because of Izzo, because of who Michigan State is. And Texas, basically, they more than held their own against North Carolina. They held their own against Michigan State for most of the game. And so I feel like it is a good sign that Texas is, you know, closer to being an elite team than they were a year ago or 2 years ago. And so, you know, they're closer to where you want them to be than they have been since at least Shaka's first year, if his entire tenure.
With a bunch of guys who are going to be sticking around
probably
for the next few years, right? Yeah. So that kind of leads me into the next part of our discussion, which is the macro of Las Vegas. We just got out of the micro, you know, you just did a little bit of macro here to lead us into, but we got to start off with, how much money do you think Shaka Smart lost in Las Vegas? Is he really a gambler, you think? I don't know about it, but I could definitely see Roy Williams going to the craps table. Or no, he's kind of an older dude. He'd be sitting there doing the multi-armed bandit,
the slot machine. No, Roy is definitely a card player. They're 100%. He's going to be playing some cards.
A bullshitter, talking to everyone, smiling, laughing.
Oh yeah,
he's boisterous.
He's probably taken $12,000 off dudes at the poker table, and they all loved it in the process. yeah, Shaka. I don't know what Shaka would be. I gotta think like he would be some sort of, I don't know, like a roulette guy or something where there's math involved. Like, I feel like he would be a dude who's got, he's calculated things.
Craps.
And so
It'd be craps. You'd be sitting at the craps table.
Yeah, maybe craps. Yeah, I can see him, like, here's the thing. Even if he lost money, there's a booster out there that probably went, it's fine, I got it. It's, you know, you're on my marker or something. Yeah. Like, I don't think we've got to worry about Shaka losing too much cash. Or, I mean, even if he did, he's got a bunch of guaranteed money still left to go, so he's fine.
I guess we can get off the gambling stuff and talk about what we're taking away from Las Vegas, which isn't money,
crabs.
But we can take away some things from these games, like what parts tell the stories of this Texas team and what they will be this year from the two games we saw in Las Vegas.
Not so much about the team, but individual things I noticed is that Coleman seems to be coming around. He is not playing his A game, but he is closer than he was. Like, I liked how he played against North Carolina. I liked how he played. Like, he seemed to be more confident against North Carolina and, you know, the start of Michigan State. I like Jace seemed to be playing within himself a little better. His defensive work was more consistent than it's been. And is, you know, when his shot's falling, great. Obviously Roach, it was good to see him go beast mode. I hope that he's able to continue to do that without sort of disrupting the offense's overall flow. Those are sort of things I saw. It's like you see individual guys who need to round into form that seem like they were starting to round into form. And hopefully they can build on that. And Tim's got to make a drink, so
Tim's
this will be a second.
Drink,
yeah.
So
yeah,
we'll wait for Tim. Yeah. Tim, how's your drink? we see the drink. Yeah, it's great. It looks like a great drink. It looks like a great rum and coke.
It looks incredibly cold.
Yeah, but one of the things I'll jump on what you're saying here. Dylan Nosikowski kind of came into his own. Not quite what he was last year still, but he definitely has found a role for himself in this team, averaging 20, 30 minutes per game and doing pretty well for himself, 13 points per game. He's been that guy who can get you some presence down low. He's not going to get you a ton of rebounds like Texas fans were used to, but he's doing his job. He's playing the role he needs to, and that's what you saw in these last two games.
Yeah, I mean, his effective field goal percentage is better this year thus far than it was last year. You know, he's grabbing more offensive rebounds as a percentage. You know, his offensive rebound percentage is better than it was last year. He's getting more steals. That's sort of the fun, surprising thing is that he's recognizing what's going on around him well enough that he's actually grabbing a pretty fair amount of steals, or more than you would expect from a power forward, just because he's, you know, he's more aware of what's going on around him. So, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, everybody focuses on his 3-point shooting and his waistline, and one of those is, yeah, his hair. But I think there are individual things that he's doing better that hopefully he, like everybody else, hopefully he can build on it, because we're less than 20% of the way through the season right now.
Yeah, well, a couple of things. Following on your line there, it's sort of hysterical to me. Like, really, truly funny. Like, I just, as a coach and as someone that follows it pretty closely, Texas just lost maybe the best interior defender that they will ever have. If they ever have anyone who's close to Bama's level or, like, around that, that would be a phenomenal thing. And yet, they are better away from the basket than they have ever been, like, in the last 20 years. They're more aggressive away from the basket. Like, it would stand to reason that when you have a guy like Bamba in the paint, that you could be more aggressive attacking passing lanes and trying to get your hands on deflections and stuff like that. And yet they don't have him, and they're still better, which is pretty cool. Like, it's a neat wrinkle that they put in for this year.
That has to be a function of the fact that they have a ton more guards last year.
Well, so with the exception of Dylan and Eli, everybody else that's getting minutes is a tremendous athlete. Like, you might be able to say that either Jace or Matt is the worst athlete of that group. And Matt is super quick and pretty long, and Jace is a 6'5 good athlete. And those are the two worst athletes in our other seven that are getting good minutes. So, I mean, Kamaka obviously has his issues, but he's a very quick, capable athlete at 6'9", right? So I think it's in no small part that Shaka has legitimately put together a lineup of long, quick, agile, good athletes all up and down the lineup. Anyways, it's just fun to see because I love how he coaches defense. As much as there are portions here or there where the offense frustrates you, like, he never, ever puts a shitty defense on the floor, ever, which, you know, I really respect. From a different macro point of view, a couple of things that I think you have to probably keep in mind. Number one is Texas is going to lose probably at least 6 games in conference. If they go 12-6, I don't know anyone who would not be ecstatic. Like, that would be fantastic. And that's
better
more
than I think they'll do. So, yes, yeah, absolutely.
Me too. So almost, you know, if they go 10-8, I will be really happy. And so you start thinking about if somewhere in that 11-7 to 9-9 range is most likely, you're probably going to have to think about what are we going to get from the non-conference. Now, going 1-1 in Las Vegas and beating who they beat at least gives you hope that they can be somewhere between 12 and 1, probably, so either 11-2 or at worst 10-3, and that's putting you at somewhere in like the 22-11 range or so. So what they were able to do gives you a lot of confidence that this is a team that, if they take care of their business in the non-conference schedule, if they can avoid some of those bad losses, like they lost at home, they lost at Oklahoma State last year on like a 1-point shot. They lost a couple of games that they probably shouldn't have last year. Well, right now they're winning those games, right? So if the North Carolina game this year is similar to the Duke game last year, well, we lost to Duke last year. We beat North Carolina this year. It was things like that as you see those pieces come together. And Texas, I think, should be favored every single game left in the non-conference schedule. Like, that's not going to say that they're going to win them all, but they should be favored. And so if you have, you know, the more wins they can stack up, even if they're not impressive, but the more wins Texas can stack up in the non-conference schedule, if they can get closer to that, again, 12-1 or 11-2 spot, then you're talking about maybe a 4-seed or a 5-seed. And so from the macro level, you like both that they're playing well against good competition, but you also like that they are giving the committee reasons to believe, hey, this is a Texas team that can perform well against other tourney caliber teams. And if they can back that up with a pretty decent record, well, you like what you're going to see. But the more wins they get non-conference, the better they're going to be knowing that they're going to lose some games in the conference schedule.
Yeah, if they can stack this with a win against Purdue, which is by far their most difficult non-conference game left, that starts to form a solid resume for the tournament and potentially for higher seeds, if they can put a winning record together in conference play.
Because there's a lot of reasons to think they could be 11. If they beat Purdue, they could be 11-1 going into Big 12 conference play. If they're 11-1 by January 1st, they will probably be 8 or 9 in the country, maybe even like 7 or 6 in the country, because other teams are going to lose. So if they can go into conference being a top 10 team, which is not out of the realm of possibility, then that gives you a nice cushion where you can play your average normal schedule and, you know, get some good wins and then see what's going to happen.
So another question I have coming out of this is one that I have been asked by a former player, a friend of mine, constantly about Texas. And it's one of his major gripes for Texas is, what is the identity of Texas? After we've seen this, Texas is now 6 games into the season. They played 2 great teams. What is the identity of Texas? What is their identity on offense, and how is that going to win you ball games?
Well, so I think with Texas, with Shaka Smart, just like it was with Rick Barnes, their identity is always defense first. They are going to put out a high quality defense that will win some games for them, keep them in some games that maybe they shouldn't otherwise be in, and just generally narrow the spectrum of possible outcomes in a favorable way. On the offensive side, I think maybe the best way to put it is, I don't know if I would call it an identity so much as if we're looking for best case or ceilings What they did against North Carolina is arguably their ceiling this year. That is about as well as they can be expected to perform offensively against top quality teams. I'm not going to pretend that they can do that reliably, because that's still very much TBD, and that's something we will find out in conference play. But I don't know if I could quantify it as an identity so much. You're going to see them take a lot of threes because their offense is predicated upon getting lane touches to either get to the rim or get the ball out to the perimeter. And I guess the season is sort of going to be determined by how many of those open threes they actually connect on. And early in the season, it did not look good. But in the last three games or so, it started to look better than it did. And so what we're going to see going forward is whether they can keep building on it, or if we just saw the best part of the season.
Yeah, tough to add a whole lot more to that. I think this offense is going to do one of a couple things. They are either going to find opportunities for ball handlers to get all the way to the rim, or if not, they are going to find opportunities for ball handlers to hopefully create open three-point shots. And as any offense that relies on those things is going to do, the better we shoot from three, the more our offensive identity is going to look fine. The worse they look from three, the more we're going to say, what the fuck are we doing? So as Texas kind of goes from three, so will go our identity. But we're going to play solid on defense. We're going to play solid in the open floor. We're going to have athletes that can attack when possible. We are also going to have some questionable three-point shooting all year long. We just hope we don't have that questionable three-point shooting against a team where we need to win at home. Like, if we have questionable three-point shooting against Kansas State at home, fuck. If we have questionable three-point shooting when we're at Oklahoma or at Baylor, fuck. So hopefully we can limit our tough shooting nights to when it doesn't really matter. Like, if we're at Kansas and we shoot poorly from outside, okay. If we have tough three-point shooting when we're at home against Iowa State, well, then we're talking about a different level of frustration.
Let's go ahead and talk about the next team coming in the Radford Highlanders. Texas is now the number 17 Texas Longhorns are going to be facing off against Radford. And Radford just knocked off Notre Dame. How much stock should we put into that win? And what should we expect out of Radford on the floor?
Okay.
All right. Tim, do you want to start?
No, I don't.
Okay. Okay. So what do we take from the Notre Dame game? Not a lot. I mean, Notre Dame is sort of... Notre Dame is not the Notre Dame you think of. Like, they're not bad this year, but they're not up to, you know, likely Elite Eight performance again. It seems like they're sort of in a transitional year. They might put it all together. I mean, you know, Mike Bray knows what he's doing. As for Radford, they play slow. They play, out of 353 teams, their tempo is 335th. So basically the tempo Texas played last year. So hooray, slow. other than that, they're not a bad team. They're not a great team. They don't do a lot. Like, they shoot the three-point shot well, but again, they play so slowly, it's not like they're going to hit you with 30 out of 45 from three or something. Like, they're sort of the polar opposite of the Citadel in terms of tempo and what they're trying to do. I mean, they're slow. They make their threes, but they don't shoot a lot of them. So it's not that big of an advantage. So they're just, they don't force turnovers. They're fine. You know, I mean, that, like, it's, I'm sort of, I know there's a malaise in the way I'm describing them, but it's because, I mean, if Texas loses this, that's a bad loss.
It is, and I don't think they're going to lose. And one, if you're looking for a super positive from Las Vegas, I suppose it's the fact that a 5-1 17th ranked Texas team will draw more fans than a 3-0 unranked Texas team.
So at least a dozen more.
If they can bring a little bit more excitement from the crowd from that standpoint, I mean, Texas should be fine. And look, let's not mince words. The Texas team that did well in Las Vegas should win this game comfortably. Radford wants to control tempo, and they may well do that. Texas wants to get out and move, and we'll see if they're able to incorporate that kind of style of play against a team that is all right. You know, this reeks to me of a game that will depend on which Texas shows up. Do they have ball handlers that are comfortable against a packed-in defense of getting all the way to the rim? And that's what I'm going to look for is as we move forward, the jury is probably in at this point that if you want to truly beat Texas, you're going to have to pack it in. You're going to have to sag against their offense. You're going to have to make them perform and execute against a congested lane. And so what Texas needs to do against that is they need to that much more forcibly, that much more purposefully, still attack the lane off of their dribble penetration. So can Matt, against a congested lane, still get into the lower part of the lane? Can Kerwin, against a congested lane, still get all the way to the rim? Can we find ways to create dribble penetration, even against defenses that are really packing it in? A guy like TJ Ford could do that. Even if you were sagging against him, he was fast enough to beat you. And we were good enough with our rotation to make teams pay. And Texas has not necessarily shown that at this point of the season. So can they start figuring that out against teams who are probably going to default to, all right, let's see you execute against us when we're playing under ball screens. Let's see you execute against us if we're going to, you know, go to 2-3 zone 30 or 40% of the time. So Texas should win relatively easily, but I could still see ways that Radford would say, all right, well, prove to us that you can execute against this kind of set 60 or 70% of the time.
Yeah, I guess with a team like Radford who plays as slowly as they do, it's kind of hard to blow them out because they slow things down so much. So it's just if you get 12 less possessions in a game, that's, you know, how many less points you're going to get, say 15, 18 points. So, you know, it's hard to rack up a 25-point win against a team that, you know, only allows you to get to like 65 to 52. Like, so it doesn't feel as impressive as it would, you know, like the game against Citadel where everything was going ball to the wall. But yeah, I'm not worried about this Radford team. The only thing I'm worried about is the only possible negative outcome I see is if Texas comes back from Vegas thinking they're hot shit and they can just roll the ball out there and win just by being them. Then maybe this thing is uncomfortable. But if they execute the way they should execute, if they're focused the way they should be focused, then I'm not too terribly concerned.
If they come out like that after the last 2 years, then we have a whole new set of problems with our coaching staff. Like, if this coaching staff can't get these guys to say, who were we 2 years ago? Who were we last year? And now all of a sudden, like, we're guarding against complacency. Like, come on, get your shit together. So I would hope that won't happen, but we'll see.
Yeah, and then especially with not this week, but next week's two opponents in VCU and Purdue, you better hope that doesn't happen. But on that note, y'all, we're going to end off here. Thank you for pretending we were football for the past hour. I've been your host, Will Baizer. You guys can find me on Twitter at WILLBAIZER. Johnny Brashear, where can we find you?
On Twitter and Instagram, at BitterWhiteGuy. I'm also on Barking Carnival, your leading basketball blog for Texas sports.
It really has become that, hasn't it? And yeah. Johnny, where can we find Timothy Preston? In the world is Timothy Preston?
Where can you find Tim? Let's see. One of the things that many people don't realize about Tim is that he is actually the owner of the last Blockbuster in Alaska, and he often spends his time commuting. I mean, it's a long commute, and I don't really understand why he lives in Iowa and still commutes to Alaska. You would think that the profit margins on a blockbuster at this point are low enough that it wouldn't really justify those plane trips. But he still does it because he loves VHS tapes. I mean, so much. His wife's wedding dress was made out of VHS tapes.
Not taken apart. They were the actual clunky.
Yeah, no, yeah, it was actual tapes, and then they were held together by actual VHS tape. So it was not. I'm gonna be honest, not the prettiest dress I've ever seen. But it
How
was.
How dare you, Johnny?
It was a commitment to the theme, and they did have plenty of available cassettes around for their sex tape on the wedding night, so that worked out pretty well.
Yeah, where in the world?
So yeah,
is Timothy
at that Blockbuster in Alaska, that's where you can find him.
And Tim, where can we find you on the internet?
Well, there are some places that I'm at occasionally. Mostly
the sports side. Let's stick to
okay.
the sports side.
Yeah. InsideTexas.com and on Twitter, InsideTexasHoop, no S. I will have you know that my wife's dress was held together by corn husks, not by VHS tape. And she looked as beautiful as a midday
May
Iowa.
Sunset?
Oh. Well, sure, yeah, that's better. That's even better. That's better than what I was going to say. So that. She looked that beautiful.
And you guys can find us and our other shows on the Hornscast channel, what you're listening to right now, at Podbean, Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, Twitter, Facebook, anywhere. Anywhere you can find
a
podcast.
That is a really unfortunate app name. I got to be honest.
Sheesh.
Yeah.
Anywhere you guys can find a podcast, you'll find the Hornscast.
Will has emphysema.com.
Thank you for listening, and we will see y'all next week. Hook 'em.
Hook 'em horns. I hope that Kyler Murray throws 7 interceptions and that
is a close acquaintance with the turf.
Yeah. I can't remember his name. Who's the white Texas safety that dropped the pick against Texas Tech? Gideon. I hope that Gideon returns 6 of Kyler Murray's interceptions for touchdowns. That'd be fantastic. Just the best. Is that possible, Will? Can that happen?
No, but there is a new player on the team named Blake Bidian.
Ooh! A preferred walk-on if I've ever seen one.
Mm-hmm.